Good evening, everyone. It is just so nice to be here. I really regret that I don't come by more often just to sit with you. My health is not great, it's unpredictable. And a friend of mine, a fellow Zen teacher who's about my age, says, "You know, at our age, the battery runs a little low." So it's hard to get up the oomph to come as often as I might like to. But it's really lovely to be here. And I feel that you're a sister, brother, cousin, Sangha. And I want to let you know that you all are welcome to come to our place really anytime, just to drop in, sit, and you know, have your main place be here. But it's nice to have the support of really all people of goodwill and all people in the Dharma. In preparing for this talk, I was reminded of a experience where Sheng Yan came to talk at the Berkeley Zen Center. And he started his talk by saying, "So I asked your teacher, Sojin, what should I talk about?" And Sojin said, "Why don't you talk about how your practice is different from our practice?" And Sheng Yan says to Sojin, "Well, what if my practice isn't different from your practice?" To which Sojin replied, "Well, then you can go or stay." So, in a way, this talk is about the Sandokai, how to harmonize sameness and difference. But I'm not going to talk about the Sandokai. I'm just going to share with you some of my thoughts and experiences over the various years of practice. There's a saying by Dogen, it appears in Zenki, "Although not one, not different. Although not different, not the same." That applies to so many things. I mean, really, to everything. Well, how does it apply to us? I was thinking, how are Valley Streams and Meadowmind the same? Aside from our roots in Soto Zen practice, we all share a dilemma that a friend of mine, some of you might know Alan Block, from Norman Fisher's Sangha, goes way back to Suzuki Roshi. And he was saying, "I just don't know these days, how are people ever going to really get Zen without being able to live for several years at Tassajara and go to, you know, 50 sessions and have residential, how are they ever going to get it?" And I said to him, "Well, that's the question. Yeah, that's the question. And it's a question for all of us. I have many friends who've lived or taught at Tassajara. Some of you know Linda Galagin is becoming the abbess of Berkeley Zen Center. And she was a student of mine in psychology years and years ago, and it's fun to see her ascending the mountain seat. But, you know, she's lived, I don't know, 20 years, 25 years in Tassajara, long time. And the fact is that most of the people at Berkeley Zen Center and most of the people in most Dharma centers aren't in residential settings. And so, how do we develop the Dharma and our practice of the Dharma in daily life? Now, one of the ways is to find supportive sanghas. And maybe these days, I mean, so many people have mixed practices. You know, they do a little mindfulness, they do a little koan study, although I don't know if you can do a little koan study. A little of this, a little of that, and with the Dharma Center and Meadow Mind and Valley Streams, you could sit meditation pretty much every day of the week. I kind of grew up in Zen at Berkeley Zen Center, where we had Zazen every morning and every evening, 6 days a week. And that was wonderful. And even though it wasn't residential practice, it was maintained by five or six people who lived on site, some of whom were priests, some of whom weren't, some of them were lay people, but it was a continuous practice. So there's a fascicle by Dogen, two fascicles, continuous practice. How do we make our practice, how do we make our life our practice? I think priests need to make their practice their life, and lay people need to make their life their practice. Two sides of one coin, kind of. So I'll share with you a few things that I do. I start every day by reciting the Four Noble Truths. And often I'm kind of groggy in the morning, but I won't eat my breakfast till I say the Four Noble Truths. And sometimes the first truth is, beings are numberless. I vow. No, my vow is bringing all to each. I mean, that's my version of the vow. I get confused because I've gone through different versions for myself. Delusions are inexorable. My vow is clarifying. Dharma gates are boundless. My vow is journeying. Usually by the time I get to Dharma gates are boundless, I've woken up a little and I can actually sort of go, oh yeah, right, right. My vow is journeying. And the way is unfathomable. My vow is attuning. I'll come back to the notion of attuning. You might notice that I don't say, I vow to, just because for me that sounds like that's something I'm going to do, whereas to say my vow is clarifying, the vow is doing something to me. And where does the vow come from? Well, somewhat from me, but somewhat from the Dharma, and to let it all sort of turn that way just kind of gets me going in the morning. And then our Sangha is really a blend at Meadow Mind between Soto Zen, which is my deepest roots, and Ordinary Mind Zen, and Taoist practice. And I'll come back to how those all intersect along with a little psychology. But Ordinary Mind Zen, some of you know that Joko Beck was at Zen Center of Los Angeles originally before starting Ordinary Mind Zen. And she really tried to set up something which would be for lay people and ordinary, somewhat like Norman Fisher has done with Everyday Zen. So I've cribbed something from Dan Birnbaum, who's Diane Rizzetto's heir. When we leave the Zendo in the morning, the Kokyo chooses someone, anyone, to say, would you please read us out? And that person goes up and reads, may we meet the conditions that come forth in this day with openness and possibility, and may our actions of body, speech, and mind be of benefit to all beings. And then one by one we go up to whoever read that and we bow to them and then we exit. And I really like that. It just sort of smooths the way from the Zendo into everyday life. And then in the evening, we read, as we settle down tonight, may we release all today's doings, all we have seen and heard, all we have smelled and tasted, all we have touched and thought, returning each to its roots, dedicating our dreams to the liberation of all beings. It's kind of a nice way of going to sleep. And it's good to have something which starts off your day and ends your day. Then there's all the problem of what you do in the middle, which we can come back to. Also, Joko Beck put together some practice principles which are kind of aligned with the Four Noble Truths. So her practice principles, some of you might know them, go: caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, our only teacher, being just this moment, compassion's way. And then I've tweaked it a little: caught in a dream of self-separate, only suffering. Clinging, rejecting, exactly the dream. Stealing from the Genjo koan there. Here is the time, now is the place, just this, our teacher. Being a river for the world, compassion's way. You know, being a river for the world, compassion's way. I wrote that and I'm not sure what it means, but it feels right. We don't always have to understand our practice. That's important. And we've done a few other things at Metal Mind. So when we do the Bodhisattva renewal of the precepts, we also include the paramitas. And that's been very helpful. You know, the first paramita, and they're designed in a certain order. The first paramita is generosity, dana. And the study of dana over these past 5 or 6 years has been so generous. I've learned so much. You know, dana is giving and receiving. To a certain point where giver, receiver, and gift, they just are all changing roles constantly in the dance. So like right now, you're giving me dana just by listening to me. That's generous. I mean, isn't that wonderful? Just by being here, you're giving dana to each other. And that, to the extent that I can take that in, like when I sat down to do zazen, the silence here was so nice. And you know, it has a different quality to it than the silence in our sendo. So it was so nice to take that in and try and give it back to you. So that's just a little bit more about Joko and ordinary mind, which, you know, if you went to a lot of ordinary mind Zen centers, I've been to a number of them, they look, and what they do in a session looks an awful lot like what you'd see in a Soto Zen session, except that nobody's wearing robes, you know. And maybe people share the doshi position, but basically it's pretty similar. But Joko's very down to earth. One of the readings that we do is Joko says, we can talk about oneness until the cows come home. But how do we actually separate ourselves from others? How? Now, I like that. You know, when I sometimes like to start a talk by saying, here we are, here it is, here we are. And actually just tonight I was thinking, nah, that's too separate. here we is. Here we is. This, just this. It's kind of simple. And, you know, each of us is a part of the whole, and we're wholly apart. So I like to say our practice is about becoming wholesome, leaping beyond many and one. Wholesome, wholesomeness. How do we live a wholesome life? And Joker says, well, the problem is the pride out of which anger and fear, greed and delusion are born is what separates us. And the solution is a practice where we experience the separating emotion as a definite bodily state. I think the first step is just realizing how we separate ourselves. Great realization of delusion is enlightenment. Joko says, when you really let yourself experience what's happening, a bigger container is created. That's her ABC, a bigger container. And what is created, what grows, is the amount of life and death I can hold without it totally throwing me off. And at first that space is restricted, but it gradually grows, never needs to cease to grow. And this bigger container isn't a thing. Awareness isn't a thing. But whatever experiences and witnesses our body and mind is somehow bigger than we are and includes us and isn't different from us but isn't the same. It's an enormous, compassionate space. An enormous, compassionate space. Buddha said in the Sharanagama Sutra, if you want to understand the Dharma, study space. And a good way of practicing is just when you're feeling like this, to feel the space that's within and around and find that space. I don't think that's Soto or Rinzai or Christian or Jewish or Muslim, that kind of spaciousness. We don't know what that is exactly, but I think we have some sense of it. So Joko says, as we experience and practice and cultivate a bigger container, compassion and wisdom grow. Now this is very much in keeping with Taoism. Taoism has just three precepts. The first is being compassionate. The second is being sparing. Knowing enough's enough, you don't need more. And the third is not putting yourself first at the forefront of everything. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. So compassion. When I think of what practice has been and what I've learned, if I had to go one word, compassion. And what gets in the way of that? And how do we cultivate it? Sojin, my teacher, said, the function of wisdom is compassion. How do we let go, which is an act of wisdom, and at the same time open up and embrace what's necessary with compassion? So here's same and different again. When you let go, you have to be able to take in as well. And when you take in, you need to be able to let go. So it's this constant flowing. And Sojin, in this talk, has several teachings about letting go. He says, to let go doesn't mean to stop caring. To let go is not to fix, but to be supportive. To let go is not to judge, but to allow another to be a human being, whoever they are. To let go is to fear less and to love more. That's pretty nice. I think we get confused about what renunciation is. And sometimes it shades into pushing away. Don't be attached. I had a discussion with Eve Marco, who some of you know her. She was the wife of Bernie Glassman and very active in Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And she said, well, what about love? I mean, really, come on, if you're a householder and you get involved with someone, I mean, isn't love going to involve attachment? And I said to her, this was a good question. In thinking about it, I responded, well, if by attachment you mean if they die or go away, that you miss them and feel sad, love involves attachment. But if by attachment you mean when they start to go away, you say, you can't go. Stay here. I need you. That's not love. It gets tricky. How to manage love as lay people? There's not a great deal in the Buddha Dharma which talks about this. But we need to talk about it. And when Sojin says letting go is not judging, but letting others be human beings, I think he's talking about letting be, letting everything be as it is, acceptance. In Taoism, we talk about letting be as assisting the self-becoming of all being. I like that. Assisting the self-becoming of all being. Now, what if the person who you happen to love is self-becoming in a direction you don't like? It happens, right? Well, you want to assist them in being themselves, really. Barry Magid, another teacher in Ordinary Mind, said, one of his Dharma heirs was saying to him, so Barry, your basic teaching is just accept yourself. And Barry went, yeah. And his student said, I think you sometimes accept yourself too much. And Barry went, yeah, you're probably right. That's part of it. It's part of it. When you can't let go, acknowledging you can't let go is letting go. When you're deluded, acknowledging you're deluded is enlightenment. But there's a problem with letting go. Let go, let go, let go. We hear that a lot. Do you really want to let go of everyone you love? Well, you can't hold on to them, is basically the truth of the Dharma. but to want to let go of them. If I let go of everything, what's there left to rely on? And here Taoism and Buddhism part ways a little bit. In Taoism, letting go means attuning to the Tao. Now, we talk a lot about emptiness, which is sometimes translated as vastness, sometimes translated as things as it is. But we don't have God. We don't have an underlying field, necessarily, that we can rely on. Whereas in Taoism, Taoism does. And sometimes people confuse Tao with Dharma. It was actually translated that way for a while. Again, same different. I'll read you something, a very old text describing Tao. In the beginning of the time of non-being, amorphous and obscure, mysterious and subtle, Tao was pervasive. As the source, it does not depend on anything. Therefore, it's formless and nameless, though great and universal. Heaven cannot cover it, nor can the earth bear it. So that's kind of close to emptiness, but it is because of Tao that what is small becomes small and what is great becomes great. It prescribes one single regulation without change, yet it's fitting for all things, including those that move with legs and those that crawl like worms. Obtaining it, I would say manifesting it, birds fly, fish swim, beasts run. Everyone makes use of it, but no one sees its form. One is its name, ungraspable is its abode. Wu Wei, non-action, being non-being, is its just naturalness. Harmony is its function. The Supreme Tao is beyond investigation and is fathomless. And attuning to the Tao is the practice. And it works better when you can be in sync. I mean, we all know what that's like when things are, yes, you know, you're meeting the needs of the moment. So, kind of close to Dharma emptiness, but kind of different. So, Taoism has a different relationship to teaching and practicing than Buddhism does. And I'm going into Tao because this was an equal important practice for me with my teacher, Shermu, Master Wei Liu. So the idea in Tao, the idea is somewhat similar to you're already enlightened, except they really mean it. You don't have to do anything, but you can easily mess it up, and the people who mess it up the most for us are the teachers. They say, you know, the Taoist people who really know Tao are deeply ordinary, profoundly unremarkable, common as mud. So a lot of Zen teachers like to accord with that, but there's a little bit of specialness which can sometimes creep in. Diane Rossetto was a Dharma heir of Joko Beck, and she was originally a student of Mel's, Dzogchen's, my teacher. I met her at a 70th birthday party for Dzogchen, I think. We were at the same table, and I said, you were a student of Mel's? I mean, why did you leave? And she said, it's not that I had a problem with Mel. I learned a lot. I'm deeply grateful to him. But when I met Choco Beck at a meeting of women Dharma teachers, she was sitting in the kitchen of a friend's house, and she introduced herself as, "Hi, I'm Choco Beck." And it was like just meeting anyone. Just meeting anyone. There was nothing special about her. And I thought, I want to be like that. And I love, honor, deeply revere Mel, and am tremendously grateful. And the fact is, when you met him, there was something, he had a sense of presence. And I've heard people talk about, the sense of presence. And some people have that just naturally, and that's fine. And for some people, you encounter it, and it feels a little like they're trying to be that way. I cultivated a sense of presence for a long time. And then I think the turning point came for me when my Taoist teacher, who is also a devout Buddhist, you know, her ashes are at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. She painted 108 bodhisattvas. She was Confucian. But she'd tease me. She'd say, "Oh, you Buddhists, always talking about old age, sickness, death, suffering. We Taoists say, live a long life. Be happy." And this is not a Buddhist Taoism thing. If you met her husband, Shifu Chang, he had such presence. I was scared of him for the first 10 years. I mean, he was, you know, the world master of Guan Ping Yang Tai Chi. And you knew it. You did not mess with Shifu. And Shifu was just very ordinary and so wholesome. And so just natural. So, the role of teachers is, you know, in Zen we say there's no teachers of Zen, right? I don't say there's no Chan. I just say there's no teachers of Zen. Zhuangzi, the Taoist, says, everyone has the mind as their teacher. There's only one problem. They think they have to understand it before they listen to it. That really impressed me. Do you listen to your mind? There is a school of Buddhism, sort of the mind-only school of Buddhism, which brings out something like the Tao as a ground of being. But it can be out there, and if you don't listen to it, then what? So the place to start is listen to your mind and see what it's saying to you. Listen to your enlightenment and let that be your teacher. Well, that sounds nice, but in the face of all the suffering in the world, how can you hear it through all the noise and the suffering? One of the big issues for me over the last 5 years or so, maybe longer, is so Avalokiteshvara hears the cries of the world and smiles. How? How? Choko says, you know, as long as we live, we find there's a limit to our container. We cultivate a bigger container, and we come up against our limits. I don't know if you've ever felt that, but I know there have been times in practice where it feels like I'm stretching and stretching, and I can't stretch anymore, and the universe is asking me to. and I can't. That's actually Genjo Koan. That's the fundamental point where the rubber meets the road. So Joku says, it's at that point we must practice. And as we do this practice, we need to be compassionate with ourselves. And, you know, I originally started in Rinzai Zen, and the compassion for self in Rinzai Zen is sometimes a little hard to find. It's pretty samurai-esque. We need to recognize when we're unwilling to do it, because no one's willing or able to do it all the time, and it's not bad when we don't do it. We always do what we're ready to do. Now, compare that with Dogen saying, when you find yourself where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. Practice, practice, practice. Practice as though your hair's on fire. That's good. But when you find yourself where you are, practice occurs. Sometimes we lose track of where we are. We feel unsure of where we're going and how to proceed. Then what? Then what? And sometimes this little judgmentalism comes in. You're not practicing hard enough. You're not practicing well enough. If you were only practicing well enough, you'd be able to get through this. Bullshit. Sorry. But everyone's always doing the best they can. You are always practicing the best you can. Doesn't mean you can't practice more or can't find better ways to practice, but at any one moment, you are doing the best you can. That's where to start from. And when you feel like, I can't, it's not working, what do I do now? For me, at that moment, wonder opens what seems to be locked. Wow, I actually had an experience a few years ago where I know a lot about dealing with chronic pain. I've had chronic pain for 30, 40 years. I created chronic pain management programs. And there was one time I woke up in the middle of the night and the pain was a 15 on a 10-point scale. And I just went, I can't stand it. And at that moment, and thank heavens for years of practice, something went, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. I didn't have any idea you could have pain that bad. That's incredible. And a smile came up. It hurt just as much. Didn't help the pain, but it was different. So how do we put a smile into our heart? There's a ordinary mind practice by Ezra Beta, breathing into the heart for nothing to do, no one to be. And I've altered it slightly when I can't do that, to go breathing into the heart. For just this moment, smiling, nothing to do. For just this moment, just being with it. Acceptance, acceptance, acceptance gives rise to compassion. It just does. It's a mystery. This awful, awful, oh my, oh. Something softens. And from compassion comes kindness, and from kindness comes joy. So I'm currently writing a book on the Taoist Zhuangzi, and kind of reviewing so Zen and Soto Zen and Ordinary Mind Zen and Taoism and psychology, and how do I put that all together? And I'll just read you the first page and a little poem. And then we'll stop and do questions and discussion. When I was young, I feared I'd let life slip by. So I turned to Zen, and over 55 years of practice, I learned as long as I don't fear pain and loss, I won't miss my life. I won't fail to live it and experience it, and my death, I hope. Confused, conflicted, often depressed, I turned to psychology, and I practiced for 45 years and learned happiness isn't a feeling. It's a way of life. It's a way of living your life. I wanted to enjoy my life. I turned to Taoism, practiced 35 years, and I learned ease and joy are just natural. Really honest. Just look at a flower. Look at the wet pavement. Hear the rain on the rooftop. It's just natural. So Zen and Taoism and psychology, they gave me a kind of net for my life. But now I'm at the age where the net kind of frays. The strands unravel. But there's also some loosening of the knots. And at 76 years old, there's nothing to turn to other than to continue turning. I see some of the older folks going, yeah, yep. Nothing will save me from myself, from life, nor death. So I'm kind of letting go of any particular brand of practice of, I'm a Soto Zen, no, I'm a... I'm letting go of any hope some special path will lead me anywhere but this. Ah! So I continue practicing not in preparation, but to put this body and mind in play, meeting whatever comes as best I can. There's a poem Dogen quotes. It's written by a layperson. And it comes back to, so how do we find a practice which works with everyday life? It's from the fascicle, Flowers in Unbounded Space. Radiant light serenely illuminates all the sands of the Ganges, innumerable worlds, all sentient beings, ordinary and sages, equally my family. A single moment, beyond birth and death, whole body and mind, undivided. A subtle mind movement, the six sense roots, sheltering clouds. Attempting to cut myself free from delusions and passions adds to my heap of spiritual sickness. Pursuing truth, chasing thusness, wrong. Submitting myself to worldly conditions, no hindrance here. Nirvana and birth and death, simply flowers in unbounded space. Just sorry, but for a moment, I'm just seeing all of you as flowers. It's amazing. You're all blossoming as yourselves. I'm so grateful. Thank you. Thank you. So maybe you have thoughts or questions.
Sounds like it works.
You guys need your phone.
This works.
Maybe one on this side.
Oh, okay. Well, I got to change battery. I'm sorry. We replaced it because it was dying.
Okay.
Let me do that real
quick. Thanks, Bob. Could you say a little more about, I didn't quite catch it, breathing into the heart?
Yes. So the Ezra Beta meditation goes, breathing into the heart, nothing to do. Breathing into the heart, you say to yourself on an inhalation, and then as you exhale, you say, nothing, no one to be. Breathing into the heart on the inhalation, on the exhalation, just being. Then it goes on. Breathing into the heart, breathing out kindness. Breathing into the heart, breathing out any blocks I'm aware of to kindness. Breathing into the heart, breathing out just being. It's a nice meditation. I've just did it for just this moment, because sometimes it's so hard. When a friend or a student has a spouse who is worried about being deported because they're from South America and they look that way, and even though they're a legal citizen, all bets are off. And one of the children has just had a stroke at 40 years old and will be incapacitated for the rest of their life. And another of the children is about to be sent to prison for something that they didn't do. And you've just been told, my friend's just been told, they have cancer. And you go, okay, you know, just breathing, not so easy at a time like this. But to just be with them, in grief, in just acknowledging, okay, we're here right now. Taking it a moment at the time. I remember Alan Sunaki said when he was really sick, one breath at a time. And one of my medical problems is I have lung problems and lung scarring, and I often have troubles breathing. So one breath at a time doesn't work real well for me when I'm feeling that way. And actually, about 20% of the population has problems with breathing. And so what do you find to rely on, if not the breath? I think that's really important. Whatever your practice is, what can you really rely on? And to know that in your bones and in your marrow is a great gift.
Thank you for that talk. It was very wide-ranging. One of the things you were talking about was the whole business with the Tao of acceptance. And the first time I ran into that kind of acceptance was actually in Al-Anon,
mm-hmm.
right? Where it was, and that was such a brand new concept to me. I mean, the way I was raised, you know, you're always trying to do something,
right.
You know. So the idea of that just being in the world is enough, just that in of itself was such a new thing to me. So, from that root, a lot of things sprang, right? And so for me, I really get the whole thing about acceptance, breathing. Breathing is not the right word, but compassion flowing out of acceptance. And but I find that in Zen as well, but it's just kind of in a different, has a different tone to it.
Oh, I agree. It's fundamental to Zen practice. And it's hard to put into words because for a while I would practice acceptance as, all right, I can accept this. That doesn't work. It's more like, huh, that there's a great passage in Zhuangzi where he's walking along and a tree starts sprouting out of his elbow. And it says, and his friend sees this happening and says to Zhuangzi, are you annoyed? And Zhuangzi says, yes! Well, no. Well, yes. Well, nah, my body was just lent to me. It's a conglomeration of things. I mean, why should I be annoyed if it's time to, you know, give it back? You know? But it's sort of like sometimes in Zazen, in between the breaths, in between the thoughts, it just is. And it, to call it is, or to call it isn't, doesn't quite get to it. It's just, it is, as you say, it's not a cognitive acceptance. I think it's related to Tozan's or Dongshan's. I am not it, it actually is me. When the tree sprouts out of your elbow, or I have troubles breathing, and you stop going, it's my elbow, it's my breath, how dare there be problems with it? I should be in control of it. And you realize, oh, I'm a gasper. The gasping is me. The tree sprouting out of me is me. It's sort of like, it was very hard for a long time. My kids grew up, and somewhere around the, when they were in their 30s, I went, I guess I really am a father. I just couldn't believe it, in a way. It just didn't fit. But my kids had no question about it. They just looked at me and they saw, Dad, that's who you are. You're Dad. It's like, I guess it doesn't matter what I think about it. Okay. We really are just heaps of causes and conditions which come together and fall apart. And, I mean, right now, acceptance means we're all here. It would be different if any one of us turned their back right now. Everything would change. And who I would be different if you turned your back on me. But to give up that sense of me, 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 I'm me, I'm me, it doesn't matter what you do, I'm me, I'm me. Sorry. Sorry, it just doesn't work that way.
Well, I was enjoying the plethora of sort of pithy phrases, I guess, that you were like throwing out and then turning them around and all of that. So it just reminded me of how if, like, there's a phrase for, this is just an example, like, wisdom is what's beneficial. Mm. And I remember like really loving that, and this, and so I kind of related it to some way I was treating myself. Mm-hmm. And so I was with all of that, and then, but it was as if that phrase kept working at inside me, beyond my awareness.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, some situation that I was not going to participate in, suddenly the words came back.
Yeah.
Wisdom, it's what's beneficial. And then it was like, oh, I have to go to that event. So it was really just the value, I guess, of letting, like a mantra or a
yeah.
phrase, just turn and not go with the first, just the first meaning that comes. So that's what I wanted to share.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It's yes, I found it's so helpful to live with a phrase for a while. And sometimes you'll hear a phrase and it just catches you. And then to just live with it, and sometimes it goes out of consciousness and then it comes back. And it raises a question for me. In our practice settings, you know, should we just be saying the same thing over and over again? I mean, like the Metta Sutta. Maybe we should just recite the Metta Sutta 3 times every meeting. Monday morning, Monday evening, Tuesday morning, Tuesday evening. Just the Metta Sutta till it gets absorbed. And then I feel, well, but there's the Sandokai, and there's the Enmeijuku Kanongan, you know. And this is a problem for us who aren't having 3 services a day. It's not such a problem if you're having many services, but when it's once or twice a week, how to get it saturated? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that? Well, I see both Clem and Jody do.
Yeah, Bob. I have a chanting practice at home, and I share your notion of learning the sutras because they become ingrained in you. I became aware of this phenomenon. You know, I was a scouter for 20 years, and every week you get up and you recite the scout oath and the scout law. And the scout law is not something easily memorized, but after you learn it, it just becomes ingrained in you, and those, once they're in, they tend to come back
yeah.
out. So the Metta Sutta is an excellent example of if you can get that ingrained in you, it will come out.
Yes, yes. Jody, you had a thought as well?
I was going to say something similar. And also I think sesshins are helpful because in sesshin things do repeat. And I've found myself wanting to memorize some of the sutras after sesshin. And there's some sutras that are in Japanese, like the Enmei. Mm-hmm. So the Enmei, when I first heard it and chanted it, I had no idea what it meant at all. But the way that, this was a Rinzai session, and the way that it was chanted, and they repeated it so many times, mm-hmm. chanted it 33 times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just kind of, it was so uplifting, it so sank in. And then, like, years later, I never even wondered what it was about, because it just made me feel good, right? And then years later, I asked what it was about, and I was astounded, because what the kind of meaning of it was what I was feeling mm-hmm. from it without having mm-hmm. any idea. So I think sashins are a good place also to find things like
yes.
that.
Yes. Although you never know what's going to come out of a sashin. What time do we end? Now?
Now or soon. Soon about now.
Okay. Well, an amusing story. Oh, but you have a thought first.
Well, I was just going to say, I have little sticky notes.
Yes.
Not to, you know, call my, remind me. Because that's, you know, the whole thing. We have to remember not to forget. We have to remember not to forget.
Yes. Yes.
So.
Yes. It's, and if you put up those sticky notes, mm-hmm. which is a good way of bringing your practice through the day, sometimes they benefit someone else who comes along and sees it and goes, huh? You know. So I'll just end with a very ordinary, somewhat amusing session story to compliment what you were saying, which I completely agree with, to let it come in and come in. But there was one 7-day session where I sat down and I realized I wanted a Ben and Jerry's New York Super Fudge chocolate bar, ice cream bar. I went, okay, you know, accept it, acknowledge this, let it go. Let it go, came back. 7 days of Ben and Jerry's New York super chocolate fudge ice cream bar. I wanted. Okay, I'm accepting that I'm having this. That's okay. It's still there. So you can guess at the end of the session, it was like, whew, okay, I'm going to the 7-Eleven and getting a New York double fudge chocolate bar. And I did, and it didn't taste as good as I thought it would. And that was really valuable for helping me learn something about desire. But it's not what I asked for or wanted. Thank you so much. It's really helpful to me to know you're here doing your practice, meeting together. It strengthens me in my practice, and I'm very, very grateful for it. Thank you. And thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.